The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the October 4th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Red Pyramid by Vladimir Sorokin. To put it plainly, Yura confused Fryazino with Fryazevo and went the wrong way. Natasha had explained everything to him. Go to Yaroslavsky Station and take the train toward Fryazevo or toward Cherkovo. Her station was Zagorianskaya, and not all trains stopped there. The train toward Fryazevo did, but the train toward Fryazino didn't. Yura ended up on the train toward Fryazino. There's a train at 6:15. It runs regularly on weekdays, Natasha had said, standing in the Dynamo station and licking the ice cream sandwiched between two round waffles that Yura had treated her to. That train always stops at our station. And how long does it take to get there? Yura quipped, chopping on his own ice cream and waffles. 45 minutes, Natasha smiled. You'll be at my stop by 7. This was the third time they'd met, but for some reason they were still using the formal word for you. Will it be a big group? Well, I don't like small ones, Natasha laughed, shaking her head. She always shook her head when she said something funny. Because of this, she came off as too sincere, perhaps even foolishly naive, but she wasn't stupid. Yura had quickly figured that out. He liked her more and more. Short, tan, slender, fidgety, and always smiling. She clearly had some southern blood running through her veins. Moldavian or Armenian, maybe even Jewish. Yura hadn't asked her about her roots yet. There was always a wave of joy emanating from Natasha. Her hair was black, tied up in two tight braids that encircled her head. So, can I expect to meet a whole cohort of your admirers? He asked, finishing his drippy ice cream. No doubt, Natasha shook her head again. You got any dueling pistols? Well, my dad's got a double-barreled one. I'll provide the ammunition. Deal. Looking at her lips, which were smiling and glistening with ice cream, Yura imagined their first kiss, perhaps in front of a lilac bush. Are there any lilac bushes at your house? He asked. Well, we had one. It was exquisite, but it was dying, so Dad cut it down. They're just the tiniest bit left. Natasha finished her dessert, took a handkerchief out of her jacket pocket, wiped her lips, picked up her satchel, which had been leaning against her slender, nut-brown legs this whole time, wrapped her arms around it, and pressed it to her stomach. Well, I'm off. And then bowing her head and looking sideways at Yura, she added, see you Saturday, Yura. Well, see you Saturday, Natasha. Yura raised his hand in a fist. Natasha turned away and hurried down into the subway. She'd turned away from him just as quickly the first time he'd seen her, as she was walking across a balance beam in the gym. Then she'd done an easy cartwheel along the beam, pushed off it, and jumped into the air, her hands spread wide and her head thrown back, exposing her radiant face. She was a top-ranked student-athlete, studying at a pedagogical institute and participating in a student Spartakiada, which Yura, a second-year student in the journalism department of Moscow State University, class of 63, was reporting on for the university periodical. That was how they'd met. Then they'd gone to a French film, Under the Roofs of Paris, which they'd both already seen, Yura once and Natasha three times. Then they'd taken a stroll through Gorky Park. Then Natasha had invited him to her birthday party. And now Yura had missed his chance. He was carrying two gifts, a bottle of champagne and a book of poems by Walt Whitman, translated by Kornaya Chukovsky. The book, beautifully printed by Academia Publishers, had been at Yura's home, nestled among the many other books that Yura's grandfather had collected. Before today, Yura had glanced at it only once, flipping through it quickly and putting it back on the shelf. But when he started to think about what to get Natasha for her birthday, he remembered it. He'd already spent his student stipend on three American jazz records, which he'd bought from scalpers on Kuznetsky Most. The remaining money was just enough for the champagne. Yura had basically not asked his parents for money in 2 months. A good poet and a beautiful book, he thought, and put the Whitman into his yellow leather bag along with the champagne, and then slung the bag over his shoulder. "Could you tell me when we'll be at Zagryanka?" he asked a thin old man with a cane and a pail and a string bag. "Never," the old man replied laconically. "You got on the wrong train." "What?" "Well, the train to Fryazino has never, ever stopped in Zagryanka." Yura jumped up and looked out the window. Bushes and telegraph poles were crawling by. "What the heck?" "The next stop is Green Pine. Get off there. Take this train back to Mitishki, and then get on the train toward Fryazevo." "Damn it!" Yura punched his palm impotently. "There's no reason to swear," the old man said, and looked gloomily out the window. Cursing his own idiocy, Yura picked up his bag and walked into the vestibule. The door was missing, so the June air blustered in. "Hey, buddy, give me a smoke," a voice rang out behind his back. Yura turned around. A tough-looking guy was leaning against the wall in a corner of the vestibule. Yura hadn't noticed him when he walked in. Looking unhappily at him, Yura took a half-empty pack of Astra cigarettes and a box of matches out of his pants pocket. He removed one cigarette for himself and then held out the pack. The guy pushed himself off the wall, strode over in his loose black pants, silently pulled out a cigarette, and placed it between his prominent lips. Yura lit his own cigarette and threw the used match over his shoulder. "Give me a light, too," the guy demanded. Yura hesitated, thinking of telling him it was time to start carrying his own, but ended up lighting a match and putting it to the tip of the man's cigarette. The guy started to smoke. He had a pale, thin face with wide cheekbones and a steep chin. "Is Green Pine soon?" Yura asked him crabbily. "Who the hell knows?" the guy answered. "I'm going to see some fellas in Ivatitka, and I'm not from here. Same with you, right?" Yura nodded. The guy examined Yura dully, then leaned back against the wall and, with the cigarette between his wet lips, half-closed his eyes. Yura turned away and blew smoke out through the door frame. The train rolled along unhurriedly. This train is crawling like a turtle, Yura thought furiously. Cretinoid, idiotium, stupasaurus. He quickly finished off his cigarette and threw the butt into the dusty greenery the train was passing through. Went back into the carriage. The same passengers were sitting in the same seats. Some of them were looking at Yura, and he felt smirking. "I'm a laughingstock, and rightly so," he thought. Yura opened the Whitman and again began to read. 8 pages later, a hoarse voice on the intercom announced, "Green Pine!" Yura picked up his bag, walked out into the vestibule, the lippy man now gone, and took his place next to 3 women of various ages, an old woman, a full-figured middle-aged woman, and a young girl. The train braked with an unpleasant screech. Yuri got off with the woman and looked around. A small number of other passengers were also stepping down onto the wooden platform, then setting off in the direction of a village that was visible in the distance through the trees. The train crawled away. Realizing that he had to get over to the opposite platform, Yura jumped down onto the railroad ties and crossed the tracks, stepping over the rails, which had grown hot in the sun. As he approached the other side, he surveyed the platform, spotted a set of wooden steps, and climbed up them. There was nobody on the platform. Some cigarette butts lay on the ground. On the long lattice sign, only the word pine remained. Yura could see the outline of the word green that had once been there. "They must be painting the pines red, then," Yura joked gloomily. He walked over to a bench with peeling white paint and sat down. He looked at the Luch watch that his father had given him when he'd got into Moscow State, 6:42. "They'll start without me." He pulled out his cigarettes and then thought better of it and put them away. "Idiotium," he pronounced again, looking at the rays of light caught in the branches of the pine trees, and spat onto the filthy flooring. 12 minutes passed, then 13 more, then 20 more. The train wasn't coming. "Frick me! Happy birthday, Natasha!" Yura stood up and walked down the platform. There was still not a soul to be seen. The sun was sinking lower in the sky, already hemmed in by the trunks of the trees. With his bag over his shoulder, Yura began to walk across the dusty boards, slapping his sandals down angrily against them. "Shatometer! Tarasium! Shatasium!" The boards groaned stupidly under the blows of Yura's feet. Their groans enraged him. Having walked the entire length of the platform, he turned around, started to run, and tried to do a long jump, like a track and field athlete, compressing all his fury into his impact on the shabby platform. "Fulodancius! Shedonidius!" The boards rattled. Yura walked up to the lattice sign with the word pine on it. "A pine day. I pine for the train. Oh, succopinus, when will it come?" "In 8 minutes," someone said loudly. Yura turned around. A man was sitting on the bench he just jumped past. This was so unexpected that Yura stopped moving. A fat, puffy-faced man in light summer clothes sat looking at Yura. "What?" Yura muttered, not believing his own eyes. "The train will be here in 8 minutes," the man pronounced. There was no expression on the man's large, mealy-white, pear-shaped face. No expression at all. Absolutely no expression. It was the first time in his life that Yura had seen a face like that. "What train?" he asked, unable to look away from the man's face. "Your electric locomotive." The man's small, expressionless eyes were fixed on Yura. It seemed to Yura that the man's face was frozen, and that the man himself was from the morgue, a corpse, a dead man. Yura suddenly began to feel ill, just the way he'd felt when he'd had sunstroke in Baku last summer. His legs trembled. "Please, sit down," the man's frozen lips said. "You look like you have had sunstroke. It's very hot for the beginning of June." Yura plopped down onto the bench. He inhaled, coming back to his senses now, and ran his hand across his sweaty forehead. "It's better not to practice your long jump in this kind of heat," the man advised. Yura noticed just how fat the man was. He hadn't moved at all and was still staring straight ahead. His clothing was old-fashioned, a white Panama hat, a beige summer suit, and a white kozoborka with an embroidered collar. White canvas shoes peeked out from under his loose beige trousers. A fun friend of Yurta's late grandfather, a coin collector, a joker, a drunk, had dressed this way in the summer. He was also dead. The fat man's comical shoes, really they were low boots, brought Yura back to his senses. He exhaled, inhaled, exhaled again. He was calmer already. The gloom had suddenly passed. He felt light and cheerful. "Where did he come from?" Yura thought. "Totally out of the blue. Why didn't I notice him? Did I really, like, overheat?" The fat man stared straight ahead with calm indifference and without changing his position. 8 minutes, huh? You know the schedule? Yoda asked. 7 now. Do you have a mental stopwatch or something? And that's not all. Yoda began to feel even lighter and more cheerful. He laughed with relief and scratched at the back of his neck. So, you know everything there is to know? Almost. Okay, what's Mittelspiel? It's the middle of a game of chess. Right. What about Betelgeuse? A star in Orion's belt. A red supergiant with roughly the same diameter as Jupiter's orbit around the sun. Exactly right. Now tell me who Dave Brubeck is. The fat man's frozen lips puckered up as he whistled a pretty decent version of Take 5. Whoa! Yoda gasped. He slapped his knees and then chuckled. You're a musician, that's it, right? And musicians are usually good at chess, right? You play jazz? No, the fat man replied calmly. Come on, that's got to be it. What do you play? Sax? Trumpet? The fat man was silent. Okay, a guessing game. Then tell me this. Where is Rotten Marsh? In the Zelyskorovsky district of Zivskaya Oblast. Yura was shocked. Rotten Marsh was a place known only in Kutor, the small village where he used to go hunting with his father and grandfather. It was, indeed, in the Zelyskorovsky district. Rotten Marsh was a swamp surrounded by a forest. Waterfowl loved nesting there. How could the fat man know that? He was still sitting on the bench, unmoving. Was he telepathic? A hypnotist? He had to be a hypnotist. Probably used to work with Wolf Messing. So Yura had to trip him up somehow. He examined his surroundings, and suddenly, in the middle distance, in front of a one-story building made of white silicate brick, he saw a faded poster on a large panel. Our goal is communism. Lenin's profile was visible beneath the slogan. All right, tell me, who Vladimir Ilyich Lenin was, then? Yoda demanded loudly, folding his arms victoriously across his chest. The man who called forth the Pyramid of the Red Roar, the fat man replied calmly. Yoda opened his mouth. What? The Pyramid of the Red... What? The Red Roar. What kind of pyramid is that? The source of the endless red roar. And where is it? In the center of our capital. Where exactly? Where the center is. In the Kremlin? No, on Red Square. On the square itself, a pyramid? Yes. But where is it on the square, concretely? Its base takes up the entire square. The entire square? Yoda laughed. The fat man was still sitting with the same imperturbable calm. You know, Yura said, I live pretty close to Red Scare, on Pyanitskaya, but I've never noticed a red pyramid around there. You can't see it. But you can? Yes. Okay, then, Yura thought, the guy has hallucinations. And what does this pyramid do? Emits the red roar. Like a loudspeaker? More or less, but it emits a different kind of sound wave, different vibrations. And why does it emit them? To infect the world with the red roar. Why? To destroy mankind's intrinsic structure. Destroy it, why? So that humans stop being humans. Now, this sounds seditious, Yura thought and looked around. But there was still no one else on the platform. So, Lenin built this pyramid? No, he simply called it into being. So he, like, flipped the switch? Something like that. Well, who built it then? You wouldn't know them. The Germans then? Or Marx, maybe? Engels? Yura laughed. No, not the Germans. The Yanks, then? No. Well, then who? Where are they from? from there, the fat man replied, and then added, your train's coming from there. Yura looked out into the hot air, gazing to the left at the tracks shrinking off toward the horizon, and didn't see anything, but still stood up and put the strap of its bag over his shoulder, looked back over at the poster of Lenin. What about communism? What about communism? The fat man trained his frozen eyes on Yura. Well, isn't it our radiant future? It's not our radiant future, but the red roar of the present day. At that precise moment, a horn sounded off in the distance, and Yura saw his train. It was still far away, and its movement was inaudible. Yura wanted to say goodbye to the fat man, wanted to say something humorous and offensive, but suddenly thought better of it. He stood there, swaying in place, as he loved to do, and stared at the strange man. The man still sat looking straight ahead. Yura could hear the train now. It crawled up to the platform. He suddenly felt absolutely certain that he would never see this unusual man again. He was quite sure that the man would just keep sitting there on this empty, dusty platform. He wouldn't get on the train to Moscow. Maybe he wouldn't get on any train at all. It was unclear where this man could possibly want to go. He seemed to have grown up out of the bench itself. Yura felt bitterly sad. His eyes filled with tears. The train came to a halt with its usual screech. Yura automatically stepped inside, entered the car and sat down, wiped his eyes with the back of his hand, looked out the window at the platform. The fat man was sitting in exactly the same position on the bench, looking straight ahead. There was something painfully familiar about him. The train shoved off. Yura was frozen in place. He felt an intense yearning, a quiet yearning. He had nowhere to go and no thoughts to think. Instead of thinking, he simply remembered the fat man's last words. The red roar of the present day. Paralyzed, Yura stared out the window at the greenery, the telephone poles, the little houses, the cars, the dumps, the warehouses, the cranes, the piles of coal, the heating plants, the people, the birds, the goats, the dogs, and completely forgot about Natasha's birthday party, and missed the stop for Mitishki. He came to his senses only as the train was pulling into Yaroslavsky station. The moment it stopped, his paralysis passed. He stood up and got off the train, stepping down onto the platform with the other passengers, and immediately moved away from the crowd. He took out his cigarettes. And what about the birthday party? Zagoryanka, Natasha? He remembered everything. You idiot, he said and spat furiously. He lit his cigarette, wandered through the evening streets of Moscow, crossed the Garden Ring, walked toward his apartment on Pyanitskaya. Smoking brought him back down to earth. He must have been a hypnotist, Yura told himself and started laughing. And I got taken in like a little idiot. Red roar, a pyramid? He pulled the bottle of champagne out of his bag and opened it while walking. The cork flew out with a loud pop, scaring an old lady, and bounced off the wall of a building. The warm, half-sweet champagne erupted out of the bottle, and Yura lapped at it, drenching himself in the process. He drank the whole sticky bottle on his way home, and then left it on someone's windowsill. At home, he read a fresh issue of Youth, and went to bed earlier than usual. Sunday passed by. On Monday, Yura had two tests, and on Tuesday, he set off to Dynamo, where the Spartakiada was coming to an end. Walking into the gymnasium, he nearly bumped into Natasha. In dark blue tights, her palms white with talcum powder, she was walking toward the locker room. Hi, he said, stopping. Hi, she replied with her perpetual smile, then continued walking. They never saw each other again. You had graduated from Moscow State University and married Albina, the daughter of one of his parents' old friends. That, with the help of his father, a prominent functionary in the Ministry of Transport, he got a job at Komsomolskaya Pravda. He and Albina had a son named Vyacheslav. In the late 60s, Yura joined the party and got a job with Izvestia. He and Albina had a daughter named Yulia. In the mid-70s, he took a position as a department head at Agoniok. One July morning, he had a quick breakfast, as he always did, got into his father's old white Volga, and set off for the editorial office. The moment he drove onto Moskvoretsky Bridge, his heart clenched and fluttered in such a way that he couldn't catch his breath. Yura stopped the car by the curb. He tried to take evenly spaced breaths and massage the hay goo points on his hand, as his doctor had taught him to. Yura had already had a lot of heart problems. They'd started after he published a controversial article in Izvestia, which had been rashly approved by the department head while the editor-in-chief was on vacation. Yura was called to testify in front of the city's party's committee. "You've crossed the line of what is permissible," a man with the face of an old wolf had said to him. The department head was removed from his position with lightning speed. Yura's career was hanging by a thread. He managed to hold on to it by a miracle. His father's party connections came in handy like never before. But his heart went out of whack, and the doctor said that he had suffered a small heart attack. He spent 2 months with Albina at a sanatorium. The second time his heart acted up was when his son was implicated in a disgusting story, a gang rape in a student dormitory. Yura's father had recently died, and there was no one up there to appeal to for help. Yura had to go to a lot of offices, asking for favors and humiliating himself. His son was saved. He got away with probation. But after those 6 months, Yura had to start taking heart medication. Then the problem had gone away. But now, his heart was fluttering. It had never felt like this before. Yura just couldn't catch his breath. He got out of his car and walked to the balustrade of the bridge, laid his hands on the chill granite, and tried to breathe normally, looking out at the morning light over the Moscow River. The freshness of the water wafted toward Yura on the bridge. He tried to calm himself down, but his heart was still fluttering, like a small animal flitting around in a cage, as if it were dancing, doing the can-can. Dressed in a caftan, its paws going bam, bam. Yura breathed. His head was spinning, and two steel cicadas were buzzing in his ears. His legs trembled. He grabbed onto the balustrade and leaned over it. The water was shining below him. The water was shining. The shining water shone with shiny shininess. Stop, he whispered to himself. The heart, his H-E-A-R-T stopped fluttering. Stopped for good. Inside, Yura reigned silence. With the last of his strength, he tried to stand up straight, clutched the balustrade, and suddenly saw the Red Pyramid. It towered up on Red Square, its base taking up the entire area of the square. The pyramid vibrated as it emitted the red roar. The roar came forth in waves, flooding everything around it like a tsunami, flowing off beyond the horizon toward all four corners of the earth. The human race was drowning in this red roar, drowning as it tried to paddle through, walking, driving, standing, sitting, sleeping, men, women, old people, children. The red roar overwhelmed all of it. Its waves beat furiously against every person inside every person. Light, and the red roar, beats out of the pyramid in order to extinguish the light of man and extinguish, cannot, and why, beats, this frighteningly, and dumbly, red waves, beat, and cannot, beat, and cannot, why, beat this stupidly, furiously, six-winged, you here, next to, six-winged, you bright, you most, you eternal, you hello, six-winged, back then you were different, fat, funny, white shoes, low boots, shoes, your name. A pine day, Yoda muttered, his lips turning white as he tried to smile, and keeled over. And now, from the comments section of the October 4th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the supply chain mystery. Why, more than a year and a half into the pandemic, do strange shortages keep popping up in so many corners of American life? By Amy Davidson Sorkin. A good way to get people talking in this lingering pandemic era is to ask whether they have tried to rent a car lately. Even if they haven't, they have likely heard stories, perhaps about largely empty lots at the Atlanta airport, where customers were forced to compete in what the actress Audra McDonald, in an angry tweet, called a Hunger Games relay, or about the man who told the Los Angeles Times that he had booked a compact car to take his kids to Disneyland, only to be directed to a van that reeked of cigarettes and marijuana. But most of the stories are more quotidian. The common elements are long lines, high rates, few choices, and mysterious references to supply chain issues. What are these supply chain issues, and why, more than a year and a half into the pandemic, do they keep popping up in so many corners of life? The shortage of rental cars, as well as used and new cars, isn't expected to let up until at least next year. Last week, the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn sent an email to members explaining that certain types of pasta could be out of stock. Other purveyors are having trouble getting chicken wings. At times, it's been oddly hard to come by plumbing fixtures, construction materials, salad dressing, and even some new books. Remote work and schooling have added to the demand for tech products, contributing to long waits. Most items are ultimately available, if at a higher price. During the past year, the Consumer Price Index has risen about 5%, double the percentage it rose in the year before the pandemic. Americans are not facing Soviet-style empty shelves or having to scrap for the basics. In aggregate, we are hardly in a condition of scarcity. Still, supply chain trouble suggests that something is off with the way we're operating in the world, and that we don't yet know the extent of our vulnerabilities. The issues can also be a serious impediment to a broader economic recovery. The most obvious culprit is COVID-19. In the case of rental cars, when travel decreased sharply in the spring of 2020, many companies generated cash by selling off a sizable portion of their fleets. They may have assumed that they could just buy more cars later, but when the time came, cars weren't available. The main reason for that is a worldwide shortage of semiconductors, the chips used in automotive systems. The supply has been constrained by COVID-related plant closures in Asia, where many of them are made. Last week, The Wall Street Journal estimated that, because of the chip famine, some 7 million cars were not built. Last Thursday, Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, hosted an industry summit on the chip shortage with executives from companies including Ford and General Motors, as well as Apple and Samsung, which are also competing for semiconductors. Afterward, her office said that one of its goals is to build supply chain trust. Another is to explore how the United States can become less dependent on overseas suppliers. A White House briefing posted the same day said that the dearth of chips was dragging down the U.S. economy and cited an estimate that it may lop a percentage point off GDP growth. What's often at the heart of a supply chain issue is a labor issue. Last week, the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach were approaching a crisis state because more than 70 container ships were idling offshore in what had become a maritime parking lot. There aren't enough dock workers to unload their cargo, or enough truck drivers to move it out of the ports. Shipping rates have spiked, too. Labor shortages are the reason that so many things just seem to be in the wrong place, the prime symptom of a supply chain squeeze. Just-in-time delivery works only if you can deliver. The labor situation, too, is no doubt related to COVID-19, but there is wide disagreement about exactly how. A significant number of people who were laid off early in the pandemic because of closures haven't gone back to work, even as more businesses reopen. The factors cited include a fear of infection and an aversion to dealing with customers who are angry about policies or the lack of them requiring masks and proof of vaccination. A particular concern for restaurant workers who are also in short supply. Some essential workers, such as health aides and delivery drivers, who were hit hard by the pandemic, may be reassessing their jobs. And many of the more than 600,000 people who have died of COVID were members of the workforce. Professional reckonings have taken place among higher-paid workers, too. Transitions require mobility and time. And even with the schools reopening, a shortage of affordable daycare and of daycare workers means that some parents who want to return to jobs can't do so. Many of these circumstances, notably the lack of child care, were not so much caused by the pandemic as exposed by it. The same could be said of another shortage, affordable housing. The question of how to solve the labor issue can't be answered without an examination of values and priorities. Would it be better to persuade people to fill jobs by further cutting unemployment benefits or by raising the federal minimum wage, which is still $7.25 an hour, or raising wages generally? What about adding support for child care, paid family leave, and public transportation, measures being debated in Congress now, or increasing immigration? Referring to supply chain issues, in other words, can be a useful shorthand when a problem arises, but it's an insufficient one. For that matter, pinning the supply chain meltdown on the pandemic can be an evasion. Last week, at the Council on Foreign Relations, the Prime Minister of Ireland, Michael Martin, said that multiple supply chain breakdowns created by Brexit had been masked by COVID. The United Kingdom has faced shortages of everything from fuel to the carbon dioxide needed for processing many foods. Similarly, recent storms have caused major disruptions. By one estimate, Hurricane Ida alone wrecked 250,000 cars. Such severe weather events are a reminder that the pandemic supply chain ruptures may pale compared with those which will be associated with the climate crisis in coming years. Indeed, one of the most urgent tasks now may be to think about the two issues together. In both cases, the scramble for quick fixes, clearing down power lines, restocking pasta, can distract from the need for systemic change. The real challenge when it comes to thinking about supply chains isn't making sure that a container ship is unloaded, it's deciding how we want to live. Next, from the Department of Returns of the August 14, 2021 edition, online edition of the New Yorker magazine, the rise of the COVID midlife crisis. Why are so many women leaving corporate America? By Lizzie Whitacomb. I have a friend, Alyssa Heinerscheid, who works in marketing at Anheuser-Busch. This has always been slightly hilarious because Alyssa is one of the last people I picture when I think of beer. She's a former teen harpist. In college, she was known for planning her schedule in 20-minute increments, not shotgunning cold ones. And yet, she has excelled managing brands like Natty Daddy, Rolling Rock, and King Cobra. Perhaps because she has never been overly attached. When 2020 rolled around, Alyssa was living her Manhattan dream life. She'd been promoted to head of direct-to-consumer marketing, a position she'd designed herself, and had hired a team of employees to work under her. She and her husband, Henry, had three kids, a newborn and three-year-old twins, and they lived within walking distance of Anheuser-Busch's Chelsea office. Many of her friends were in New York City, and she was big on the coffee date circuit. "I felt like I was at peak flow," she told me the other day. Then the coronavirus pandemic happened. And, like many people with young children, Alyssa and her husband panicked. "When they shut down the parks, we were like, that's it. We've got to get out of here," she recalled. The family packed up their belongings and headed to an Airbnb in San Diego, where Alyssa's brother lives. Her mother moved in to help with childcare. 17 months later, the family is still there. At first, Alyssa was in mourning for her old life. Her world had shrunk to a tiny patch of the Southern California suburbs, a place she'd never spent much time in. Before COVID-19, she said, "I'd go visit for 5 days and be like, get me back to the East Coast. Everything moves too slow." But the place grew on her. The kids were riding bikes and visiting a neighbor's pet rabbit, and the air was full of birdsong. Her husband had taken to tooling around the neighborhood in a golf cart. "I feel like I just slipped into someone else's life," she told me. "It's kind of wonderful." She wondered what else might deserve some reexamination, like, for example, her job. She had lobbied for this position. Getting it had been a triumph. But she felt depleted at the end of each day, like something was missing. She thought about an earlier chapter of her life, more than a decade ago, when she was 25. She'd gotten stage 3 melanoma. She'd recovered, and she'd had her three children via surrogacy to avoid risking a cancer recurrence. It had been a lonely, excruciating process, and she developed an informal sideline, counseling women who were considering surrogacy or in vitro fertilization, or who were dealing with cancer, or some combination of the two. She'd had around 60 such conversations over the years, and when she thought about it, she realized that they were among the most fulfilling things she'd ever done. "Talking to women, helping women," she said. And that's what she cared most about. As the weeks passed in the quiet San Diego suburbs, she began thinking about ways to do more of this. Was there some female-oriented group that she could start within Anheuser-Busch? Or a side gig? She wanted to help people in her own cohort, professional, achievement-oriented women in their mid to late 30s. "I feel like I speak their language," she said. "I think I have some ability to make them feel less alone, to help them get through the things they've struggled with." But what were they struggling with? A friend advised her to do some market research, and Alyssa quickly got to work. She told me, "I only have one speed, which is turbo." That's how 100 Women in 100 Days began. Starting this past May, Alyssa capped off each day with a phone call to a woman. She initially called friends from college and business school, who put her in touch with their friends, until eventually she was talking to total strangers. She'd ask them questions like, "What's in your worry box?" and share her own musings. Her subjects were eager to talk about the lockdowns, their families, and their worries and ruminations. When I last spoke to Alyssa, she was on call number 90. It was like this propulsive tidal wave out of the loneliness of COVID and into other people's heads, she said. COVID-19 hit women especially hard. Their participation in the workforce has dropped to its lowest level since 1988. And there are two big reasons for this, according to Lorena Yee, a senior partner at McKinsey and the co-creator of an annual study of corporate America called Women in the Workplace. First, women were disproportionately represented in the frontline industries that suffered the most layoffs: retail, restaurants, and the hospitality industry. Then there was the fact that schools went remote and most types of outside-the-home child care evaporated, forcing many mothers to leave their jobs. This second phenomenon affected people across industries and income levels, including the women in Alyssa's 100 Women in 100 Days project. Alyssa's subjects largely hailed from the professional or corporate world. They were marketing executives, doctors, and entrepreneurs. For the most part, these women had avoided the worst outcomes of the pandemic, such as illness and financial hardship. But their lives had changed dramatically, often because of decisions they'd made in the past year. Many of them had moved across the country. A good number of them had left their jobs, scaled their work back, or had found another employer, typically to spend more time with their families. Even the women who had been stay-at-home moms prior to the pandemic were doing a lot more caregiving than usual. They were homeschooling young children, or they were looking after aging parents. But the women were also pursuing a wide variety of creative goals: studying herbal medicine, founding an anti-hate group, starting a zero-waste beverage company. A former retail executive had spent the lockdown reading Shakespeare during her children's nap time. Pre-COVID, she'd been gunning for a CEO job, but now she was pondering ways to pursue her love of literature instead. Not everyone Alyssa spoke with had made a major change to their lives, but she told me virtually everyone was contemplating it. A couple people have talked about this collective reconsideration, she said. We're reconsidering who we are, what we care about, what we want to do with our time. You might call this phenomenon the COVID midlife crisis. Why is it happening? What we see over 7 years of research is that any way you slice the data, women have a less favorable work experience than men, Lorena Yee said. Even pre-COVID, working women were far more likely to report feelings of isolation and exhaustion, and this was especially true for women of color. Then the pandemic arrived, and many jobs grew more stressful as employees adjusted to remote work. Home responsibilities multiplied. Working moms, in particular, reported putting in an extra 16 hours a week on average, according to the McKinsey study. Imagine a woman who is working more at her job, feeling this exhaustion, and working from home with an average of 3 hours of extra home duties per day, he said. It's no surprise that hundreds of women are reflecting, why am I doing this? Is the ROI, return on investment, really there? Alyssa has her own theories based on the conversations that she's had over the past few months. In her view, 2020 produced a set of conditions that forced everyone to do some soul searching. All the noise in our lives got filtered out: office politics, social engagements, little kids' birthday parties. That left a lot of time to think about things, Alyssa said. And if you weren't happy with some part of your situation, you couldn't really avoid it. Add to that another key ingredient in every midlife crisis: a heightened awareness of one's mortality. As one of Alyssa's subjects told her, it's like we've all gone through a collective near-death experience. The final straw: an outside world that seemed to be falling apart. I spoke to one of Alyssa's subjects, a marketing executive named Jesse, who described the thoughts that kept running through her head as she attended Zoom meetings last summer. The world is literally on fire. Income inequality is out of control. Racial injustice is horrifying and crying out for resolution. And I'm sitting here writing pitches for big box retailers on how they can sell more products that people don't need? She eventually got a job with a different company. Another subject was living in the Bay Area at the start of the pandemic. She recently started a new job as a general manager for a startup that made autonomous vehicle technology. The first few days of lockdown were hellish. Her job was more demanding than ever, and her two children were bouncing off the walls. She told me that she's an Indian immigrant who has always had a relentless work ethic. But by the end of the week, she had reached a breaking point. She announced to her husband that she was quitting her job. He worked at an established tech company, and she figured that the family could afford to live on his salary for a while. Her husband was shocked, she said. He was like, "What are you saying?" she recalled. "We're in the middle of a pandemic. Don't make a rash decision. You're so strong and resilient. You can do this." And I was like, "No, I don't want to do this." The next day, she gave her boss 2 weeks' notice. She spent the rest of the year going on adventures with her kids, homeschooling them using the Montessori method and exploring parks and playgrounds. When wildfires struck the Bay Area, she decided that she would devote herself to tackling climate change. She's been interviewing at climate technology startups. In the meantime, her former employer recently went public, meaning that she missed out on millions that she could have earned had she stuck it out at the company. Still, she has no regrets. "I wouldn't trade the last year for that," she said. "My kids and I are so close now. I feel so much more grounded, and I have so much more clarity." Clearly, a fair amount of economic privilege is at work here. As I listened to the tales of the 100 women, I started to wonder, how much of this is regular professional midlife crisis stuff? These women seemed a little young to be going through it, but is this just what happens when people get deep enough into a lucrative career? They have a freak out? Contemplate walking away from everything. Perhaps, but these ladies' meltdowns struck me as a lot more soulful than the behavior we associate with typical midlife crisis. Getting a Brazilian butt lift, say, or starting an affair with a coworker. The 100 women weren't screwing up their lives. They were focusing on their loved ones or on creative pursuits they'd never let themselves take seriously before the pandemic, or on important causes like the environment. Alyssa was enthusiastic about her subject's post-COVID plans. "I think 2 and 5 and 10 years from now, we'll all reap the benefits," she told me. It's sad that corporate America is losing the 100 women, but maybe the rest of us stand to gain. Next, from the Department of Hope section of the Talk of the Town, October 4th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Jane Goodall's Survival Guide by Anna Russell. Before the pandemic, Jane Goodall traveled 300 days a year to speak to audiences about climate crisis. "I used to do like 3 days in the Netherlands, 3 days in Belgium, 3 days in France," Goodall, who was 87, recalled recently. "In China or Australia, it would be like 2 weeks where they'd spread me through their country." Everywhere she went, she met young people who were angry, depressed, or just apathetic because they've told me we have compromised their future and they feel there is nothing they can do about it, she writes in her 21st and most recent book, The Book of Hope, A Survival Guide for Trying Times. Amid flooding and wildfires, impassivity and eco-grief, the question she was asked most often was, "Do you honestly believe there is hope for our world?" She does, and she'll tell you why. The Book of Hope, which she wrote with Douglas Abrams and Gail Hudson, is structured like a dialogue in which the naturalist plays whack-a-mole with the darkest fears we hold for our ailing planet. Stories of the human intellect and indomitable spirit abound. Also, the resilience of nature and the power of young people. Hope, she argues, is not merely passive wishful thinking, but a crucial survival trait. She noted, "If you don't have hope that your action is going to make a difference, why bother to do anything? You just become a zombie." Goodall was seated on a sofa in the drawing room of her childhood home in Bournemouth on the south coast of England. Shuttered in the house since the outbreak began, Goodall has adopted a relentless schedule of online engagements, zooming to multiple countries each day. Virtual Jane has been busier than ever, she said. It's hurting my voice, my eyes. She has not taken a day off in a year and a half. She Zoomed twice on Christmas, launched a podcast called The Hopecast, and in May accepted the Templeton Prize. But the pluses, she said, I've reached literally millions more people in many more countries. I was in Tanzania this morning, and then I was in the Netherlands for an interview. Or is it Belgium? In 1960, at the age of 26, Goodall left England for Gombe National Park in Tanzania to study animals in the wild. It was in Gombe that Goodall almost lost hope. She was up at dawn every morning looking for chimps. Finally, a chimpanzee she called David Greybeard, very handsome, let her observe him using grass stems to collect termites, which prompted her mentor to send an exuberant telegram, "Ah, we must now redefine man, redefine tools, or accept chimpanzees as human." In the drawing room, Goodall checked the time, 15 minutes until she needed to record a message for French university students. She poured herself a drop of whiskey. "When my voice goes like this, it's the only thing that works," she said. It was a lifesaver when she had bronchitis at Davos. Did she ever get tired? "I care about the future. I care about animals. I care about trees. I care about children," she said. "And I'm obstinate, and I won't give in. I won't be defeated by the Bushes and the Putins and the Bolsonaros, all these terrible, terrible people." Lately, Goodall has been working from an attic bedroom surrounded by objects that give her hope. A photograph of David Greybeard, a Native American talking stick, a bell made from a diffused landmine. She climbed the stairs slowly, held up the bell, and rang it. "Special," she said. She checked the time again. The French students beckoned. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.